Hey, this is Thomas Q. Jones, former UVA All-American running back, and you're listening to The Jerry Ratcliffe Show. Wahoo wah.
Welcome to The Jerry Ratcliffe Show. That's a great lead-in from Thomas Jones that we use to start our shows off. Great that Thomas did that for us. I'm Chris Graham, got Jerry here on the Zoom line, and we're going to talk some UVA football, particularly recruiting news here on National Signing Day Wednesday. And then we'll talk some UVA basketball. And Jerry, we got the list of the new additions to the class of 2022, some prep guys, some college guys transferring in. And you were on the call with Coach Tony Elliott earlier today. What does Tony have to say about this new set of additions to the recruits? A heavy on linemen, both sides of the ball, mostly offense.
Yeah, well, Chris, as you well know, with all the guys that opted out and hit the transfer portal and didn't come back, they lost essentially their whole starting offensive line. And that left them with, I think, eight guys in the room for Garrett 2J, who is the offensive line coach and was the former guy's offensive line coach. That's way under the norm. I think they moved a defensive end over there at some point, so that's nine. And so they were feeling it. I mean, with one of the nation's leading quarterbacks returning, they had to find some bodies to, you know, somebody to protect this guy. And so they hit the transfer portal. They beat the bushes trying to find some high school kids that hadn't committed that they could possibly salvage and make something out of this class. They ended up, I guess, with the 10 guys from the early signing period, I guess they ended up 22 guys in this class, some transfer portal guys. And it was interesting that, you know, Tony, having been at Clemson, were you at Alabama, where you don't really recruit, you just select. He wasn't accustomed to dealing with the transfer portal. And so it was a new experience for him, even though he retained a lot of those staff people that Bronco hired to try to research and boost recruiting a couple of years ago. And he said, you know, that one of the things about the portal was they felt like they were in on it with a few guys, and the next minute you knew we were out of the ball game. And so it's an interesting phase of football now that seems to be ever changing, and something that Tony was unfamiliar with. And I guess there are some tricks of the trade. He went out later to say that he didn't think that some coaches, in terms of dealing with the transfer portal, were on the up and up, or maybe interpreted rules and limitations perhaps a little differently than it was intended. So I think we know what that means.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, it was an education for him. He ended up getting a couple guys through the portal, particularly two linemen, Flores and Mac Hollensteiner,
yeah.
Steiner. Both those guys are experienced, and even though they played on a different level of football, they've developed. It's better than signing a high school kid who has no college experience. And, you know, both those guys had some decent offers, so it's not like you're starting from scratch. And, you know, they needed to fill up that room. And I think they have, 16 or 17 guys in that room now. And Tony said, and he's like most coaches, they'd like to have somewhere around 16 guys in the offensive line room in case somebody gets injured or leaves or doesn't have the career that perhaps coaches had hoped they would. So they need bodies, and they certainly have bodies in their room now. It's a little crowded.
So what did he say about now? So the two guys coming in, John Paul Flores from Dartmouth, Matt Hollensteiner from Georgetown, that adds some, those are veteran guys. Flores started 20 games his last two seasons at Dartmouth. Hollensteiner was a 2-year starter at Georgetown. So those are guys you presume will compete for playing time, probably starting jobs, because Virginia loses all five guys from a starting group on the offensive line. Four to the transfer portal and one to graduation. There's not a lot coming back in terms of experience beyond those five guys Virginia loses. Is there any thought from Coach Elliott that they may be looking for more experienced guys, or does he feel like he's pretty good with what he's got, which means that they'll have to have some of those young guys, either the guys who are recruited in this class or guys who are already in the program who just hadn't gotten playing time to step up?
He didn't delve into that phase of it very much. There are a couple of guys coming back that have got a little bit of experience last year in terms of offensive line play. Noah Josie, a 6'5", 310-pound guy who got a little bit of time, and he looks like he might have a promising career. Also, Logan Taylor, 6'7", 320. And Ty Furnish, all three of those guys were freshmen, but they got a taste this year. So I think there's some potential talent there. I don't know about some of these other guys that they recently recruited as high school linemen, although the one intriguing name was Snoop. I'm going to struggle with this name. I'm going to try to pronounce it. Amama, I guess.
I would go there until we know otherwise. Looking at it, it's how it's spelled, yeah.
He's a kid from out in Utah, which I'm surprised they were able to hold on to, considering they lost some other recruits from out in that region who decommitted after the coaching change. But he's a very intriguing kid. He's got huge size, huge arm span, wingspan. Had some pretty good offers, including BYU. He was the number 12 overall recruit in the state of Utah. He's somebody I imagine they will try to push early into trying to develop him, get him on the field as soon as possible. A lot of other guys who are like three-star offensive linemen that we don't know a whole lot about, other than just what their bios told us. But I think the transfer portal is kind of like Waffle House, Chris. It's open 24 hours, and I don't think it's going to shut down anytime soon. I know that the kid that committed yesterday from St. Thomas Aquinas in Fort Lauderdale, his three-star offensive lineman, Blake Steen. His brother, older brother, plays for Vanderbilt and has started for 2 or 3 years and is in the transfer portal. And I know he visited – I'm pretty sure he visited at the same time as Blake Steen did last weekend. So I don't know if they're still in the market for him and some others as well. But I would think that they are going to continue to research and look into the transfer portal, because there's still, from what I gather, there's still over 500 players in the portal. So perhaps they can dig up a couple of other guys that can help them out, not only on the offensive line, but maybe in some other spots as well.
And that St. Thomas Aquinas program in Florida is a well-known top program in a state that's known for its great high school football. Also, another player from St. Thomas Aquinas, Dawson Alsters, another offensive lineman, committing today. I was going to ask about on the defensive line. We know that's a place that Virginia also needs to put some emphasis. You don't need as many bodies there. Virginia looks like they're going to play a base 3-4 defense, so you don't need quite as many bodies as you do with a 5-member offensive line, but you do need bodies. Not only Paul Aker, the transfer from Columbia, but this name didn't show up on our list, but Aaron Faumui could be a guy we could almost count as a signing day guy, with the word this week that Faumui is taking his name out of the transfer portal. So, you know, that's That's an addition too. When you think you might lose a guy with veteran experience in your program and he's staying around, that's probably noteworthy as well.
Yeah, it was a huge get back, I guess you could call it. We figured he was gone, but the fact that he decided to return is a big boost for that defensive line, because they are going to be lacking a lot of experience. And he's a big body and you can rush the passer, and he's pretty good against the run. So, yeah, that was definitely important to get him back. The guy from Columbia, Paul Aker, I guess that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, I'm guessing they're with you.
Played in 22 career games for Columbia, which is an Ivy League team, and had 10 starts at defensive end. Had 6 sacks, 10 tackles for loss, forced fumble. So, you know, again, you're getting somebody who has been coached on the collegiate level and has some experience, and it's going to be crucial for that side of the ball to come up with something that can be more representative than what they fielded last year. I wonder if you had the same thoughts I did when you saw the schedule reveal. Was that last night? Gosh, this week's been such a whirlwind. I'm trying to remember.
I think it was Monday night, but yeah, this has been a whirlwind. So yeah, what were your thoughts on that?
You know, the more I looked at it, the more I was optimistic about what this team can do next year, even though the defense is a big question mark, because it just sets up nicely. I think it probably sets up better than any schedule in recent memory for Virginia. Looking at it here, I mean, you open up with Richmond and you go to Illinois, which will be a challenge because it's on the road at a Big Ten school. Then you come back home against Old Dominion. Then you go to Syracuse, where you'll get to maybe get a little needle into Robert and I, which I'm sure
Jason Bett, right? Yeah.
It's first time they've been at Syracuse, I think, since the Al Groh era, if I recall. Yeah. I was at that game, and I remember Marcus Higgins was so dehydrated at halftime, they had to give him some fluids intravenously at halftime because it was so humid in the Carrier Dome. People were getting cramping up and everything else, but it's been a while since they played there.
I saw a funny line today. I was watching Packer and Durham on ACC Network, and they had Scott Satterfield on, and talking about Louisville plays at Syracuse as well. And he mentioned, I think it was Mark Packer mentioned that, hey, good news for you, coach. They have air conditioning in the Carrier Dome now. And he said, well, it's not great news until they tell me they're going to turn it on.
good point.
But yeah, that game was 2005. That tells you how weird this conference is. We haven't played that team since that wasn't even a conference game back then. Syracuse had only been in the conference since 2014, so that's, you haven't right. played those guys up there for a while.
17 years. some of these kids weren't even, well, I guess they were born, but they didn't know much about football at that point. Then they come home against then they go to Duke, which is a winnable game for sure. Then Louisville comes here. They've been a little shaky. Then Virginia goes to Georgia Tech on a Thursday night. Then comes a really interesting stretch of games. I mean, they're going to play 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of their last 6 or 7 games at home.
4 in a row.
Yeah, 4 in a row. Don't have to leave the state that entire time.
Those are your hardest games. Miami, Carolina, what is it? Miami, Carolina, Pitt, and Coastal Carolina?
Coastal Carolina, and then they go to Blacksburg to wrap it up. But I don't know. You know, if I'm – I remember when we were talking to Tony the other day, and he couldn't reveal any of the games that they were going to play, but he had a – bit of a smile on his face and said, he said, when I looked at the schedule, I was pleasantly surprised. And now I know why. I think, I think if he can get something going, the schedule set up for them to have a much better year than I would have anticipated.
I'll tell you what, Jerry, you've been around longer than me, but I remember a lot from those years before I was a writer. This schedule sets up to me like some of those schedules in the George Welch years, maybe the early 90s, when you'd see Virginia teams get off to there were a few years there where they got off to like 5-0, 6-0 starts and didn't really play anybody maybe early on, but it was a great way to ease into a season. Then you play your tougher games late. I mean, I look at this, Jerry, and I know it's crazy. It's only January, or it's only February 2nd. It still feels like January to me. That's how time's going for me. It's only February 2nd. They don't start playing until September. But I looked at that when I first saw that. I said, there is a chance that Virginia could start 7-0. Not necessarily be playing great football, but good enough football. But all those games are winnable and very winnable for Virginia. And then you play your four toughest games of the season at home, you know, back to back to back to back. You could go into that Miami game 7-0 and ranked, and then find out you still may not know how good you are. But that's okay, because from Virginia fans' standpoint, Tony Elliott's first year standpoint, you know, get your offensive line kind of confident, get your defense worked out with how it's going to play. This could work out really well for Virginia.
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, we know why Tony was smiling the other
day. Totally, yes. He probably felt, you know, you were on the call. I imagine there was a Cheshire cat grin
yes,
that
he was exactly. having.
Because that is a nice schedule for a first-year coach. He knows somebody in the league office. That's the only thing you can think.
Somebody's smiling on him, that's for sure. No question. But anyway, I lost track of where we were, but
no, I like that. That's exactly, you know, it's going to be a team in transition. And I wonder if there was anything else, because the players announced today were all line guys. And of course you got to, you know, the fans probably look at this and say, well, there's no quarterbacks. They were signed, you know, there were some guys signed back in Dakota Twitty, a great receiver, signed back in December. But fans aren't going to get too excited about this. They're going to say lineman, whatever. What else did Tony talk about today as far as maybe kind of putting a wrap on the class of 2022?
Well, I asked him about the quarterback thing, and they did get two in the early signing period. Lane from Liberty Christian down there has put up some nice numbers and some really good comments about him, and Crawford, who happened so long ago, back in early December, that I forget much about him, but he said he would definitely like to sign at least one quarterback every class, possibly two, depending on the roster. He also talked about how Aaron Famui coming back was a big thing, because he says you never have enough defensive linemen. He said he, you know, the one thing about this class, considering that, you know, he didn't have a whole lot to do with it until it was almost too late, and he was almost handcuffed in the recruiting process because it was so late when he come on board. But he says he'd like to have more defensive linemen. Now, I guess this is going to be their emphasis for the next recruiting class, or at least in the transfer portal between now and whenever. Some more edge rushers, possibly a running back, another tight end, and again, maybe a secondary player. And he said, you can't have enough defensive linemen. So that's where their recruiting emphasis is going to be going forward. You and I and our good friend Scott have talked about this over the last, well, going back into football season, when we had all had some contact with some former players down in the 757, and they were upset, frustrated that Virginia had essentially waved a white flag over recruiting the Tidewater area. And so I asked Tony precisely about all that, and to see what his reaction would be. And he said, well, you know, that's definitely one of our big points of emphasis now. he said the whole state is, the DMV, the Richmond, the entire state. And they want to establish beachheads, recruiting beachheads in all areas of the state, just like George Walsh had it back in the day. He said he is, we only had 25 minutes with him. I wish we could have, and maybe this is a conversation that you have to have behind closed doors, but he said he's beginning to understand why that happened in the 757. And I wish I could have gotten to have a longer conversation about that. You and I have heard some rumors why, but
yeah,
you know, unsubstantiated. So maybe we'll come up with more on that going forward. But
maybe that's our excuse, Jerry, to see if we can get Tony to talk with us in this setting sometime pretty soon.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we'll make an effort for that. He didn't have a whole lot of time. He mentioned that I think they have four early enrollees that are already here, and he hasn't had a time to, because he's been recruiting so much and doing other things. He hasn't had time to look at those four very closely at this point. He did say some interesting things about what he's learned about his staff on all these recruiting visits. And he said, I've learned a few things. And this was pretty funny. I'm going to write about this later, but he said, you learn which ones are going to let you eat. In other words, some of the coaches want to stick on a tight time schedule. We got to be at this school at 11 a.m. We got to be at this school at 12:30, this school at 2, this school at 3. He said some of these coaches want to stick on that schedule, and some of them will not let you eat.
And he's the head coach.
He's the head coach. And he said only one guy has let me eat so far. And he said he was at the car, and he had the car warmed up and had biscuits ready. We asked him which one, and he said Clint sent him. So Clint certainly knows how to treat the head coach. And he said you also know which ones you don't want to let drive. I will change out of the shotgun seat where the head coach is supposed to sit and drive. And he said, one of the ones that I certainly will not let drive is Chris Slade. I didn't have time to interject, but I would have thought him, it's probably because he's used to driving in Atlanta, where some of the driving I've seen in Atlanta, and I've driven in every major city in the United States, but some of the driving in Atlanta, you think you're in the Daytona 500, and to me, I'm surprised there's not people into the wall all the time down there, but I imagine Chris is a victim of that.
You know, I've heard similar stories in a different sport or different venture. Vince McMahon, the head of WWE, actually a Waynesboro, he's got a Waynesboro tie. He went to high school in Waynesboro, Fishburne Military School.
He went to the military school.
He went to the military school. He insists on driving when he's going with his group, and he is also one you don't want to ride with. From people who've been in the car with him, he's 100 miles an hour. He's also taking notes as he's driving. He's looking at his phone. He's doing all these things. He can make you very uncomfortable, I'm understanding. And those who have the ability to do so say, no, that's okay. I'll drive myself. So to hear Tony say that.
I've had some similar experience with that for a couple of years there. Doug Dowdy and I drove to everywhere, Notre Dame, Syracuse, Boston College, Pitt, Florida State, you name it. And Doug has been known to, it's all right to have phone conversations, even though he didn't have Bluetooth. But sometimes he'd be reading the paper or taking notes or transcribing notes, et cetera, texting. It made me a little nervous. I didn't say much to him about it. But
I made a mistake once. Scott German and I, when we were heading to the Orange Bowl, we flew to Orlando and drove, then got a rental car and drove to our hotel, Fort Lauderdale, wherever it was. And I think Virginia's basketball was playing Navy during our trip in the car. And I made the mistake. Hey, Scott said, hey, you know, we could listen to this on the radio. You could probably pull that up on your phone. We could watch it. All right, I'll turn it on. And Scott then kept insisting that I hold the phone up so he could look. Scott, we're going 100 miles an hour on the interstate here, and you're watching Virginia basketball and complaining about it to the degree that I'm telling you're paying too much attention to this. So Tony has issues like that. And hey, you know what, about the food thing, I'm guessing that he feels like he knew all these guys, or most of these guys, because he mentioned that on Monday. He knew most of these guys going in, but he probably feels pretty good about who he hired if they're sticking to a schedule that tightly.
Yeah, that's for sure. Some of these guys are definitely all business, and not to say that Clint sent him isn't, because he got him a biscuit, but yeah, I think he's got a staff that takes recruiting really seriously.
Yeah, they're not just out there saying they're out recruiting and then let's have a 3-hour lunch. They're out there, even Clint, all he did was have him a biscuit in the car. So that's not like, hey, let's have a 3-hour lunch and hit a couple schools today or tomorrow, whenever we do. That's still pretty serious recruiting, and that's what it takes. Anybody knows sports enough, college sports particularly. It's all about getting out there, scouring the schools, and finding the guys, and getting their coaches and then the players and their families to fall in love with you, so that they want to come and play for you.
And one other thing on that Zoom conference today was that somebody asked him what it, in his mind, does it take to be a successful recruiter. And he said, I think it still hinges on relationships and being authentic and with the high school coaches. And obviously anybody that's been around Tony Elliott very long knows that he's authentic, and he wants to build relationships. And he said, you know, with each coach it's different, because some guys are just obviously friendlier and more open to that sort of thing than perhaps some others are, but it wouldn't be because of the lack of effort on his part. And he said, somebody asked him also about what if there's a coach that's trying to gain something from a recruit in terms of leverage of some kind. And Tony said, well, I haven't run into any of that yet in the state of Virginia, but he said, being from Clemson, I worked for a coach that would have none of that. And if there was a coach, a high school coach, that tried to leverage Clemson and our Dabo Swinney, Dabo said, we just don't want to have to deal with that sort of thing. And so we'll just dismiss that and go on to another player, which I'm sure at that level, you probably run into some of that from time to time. But
looking for a great dining experience in Charlottesville? Look no further than the Aberdeen Barn. The barn has been family owned and operated since 1965, with Terry and Angela providing great atmosphere and mouth-watering food at Virginia's big time steakhouse. Enjoy the fine dining or relax in the Sportsman's Bar, a fantastic place to wind down and socialize, surrounded by flat screen televisions tuned to the latest sporting events. You never know who you might bump into at the Aberdeen Barn, where all the greatest Cavaliers have dined over the decades and keep coming back for the delicious menu and good times. Check it out online at aberdeenbarn.com or call 434-296-4630.
Well, let's switch gears and talk, and we can talk more football as we get more sense of everything here. Let's talk some basketball. Virginia basketball, men's basketball, with a 67-55 win over Boston College last night, Tuesday night. A nice win for Virginia. Took the lead, you know, maybe midway through the first half, led by 5 at halftime, controlled the second half, never really threatened the second half, and continuing the tradition of this year, no 2-game losing streaks for this Virginia basketball team this year. Coming off a loss, Virginia has to this point come back with a win afterwards. Maybe a takeaway from you, or a couple takeaways from you, and then also your sense of what Coach Bennett thought of last night's win.
I thought they did what they had to do last night. again, it was another rock fight that we've become very accustomed to. And the fact that they won a home game, they held court, held serve, so to speak, keeping their head above water at 13-9 and 7-5 in the league, and still not that far out of a double bye if they can take care of business against the upper echelon of the league, as they're coming up on the schedule soon. Was impressed with Gardner. He looks like he might be settling into some consistency that we saw from him earlier when he looked like he was all that we thought he was going to be. He had 17 points, and it was nice to see Kihei. He looks like maybe now that he knows he's down the home stretch of his senior year, that he's taking the leadership role a little more personal, I think, than he perhaps did earlier in the season. He's not a vocal leader by any stretch, at least not that we see, but he does it with action. And he ended up the leading scorer in the game last night with 19 points. And Bigman keeps getting better. He showed that that's two out of the last three games, I believe, that he did not score, but he helps the team in so many other ways that he lets some other people take care of that. He ended up with 7 assists last night and a couple of steals, and was on the floor for more than anybody, 37 minutes. Franklin had his shooting touch return last night. He was 5-10, hit 2 of only 3 pointers by Virginia. This team, you know, if they can put it together, they have some possibilities. One thing I guess I was impressed with, and I didn't think about it too much until Tony mentioned it last night, was that, you know, even though they only hit 3 3-pointers and out of 7 attempts, which is the least in 16 years, I believe, 6 years. They're finding other ways to score now. They're getting to the free throw line, and they hit 26 out of 29 free throws last night. That's a lot. And the offensive rebounds, they're doing a better job of that. And forcing turnovers. Grant, the Boston College coach, said last night, when there's only a 57 possession game and you have 14 turnovers, which led to 20 Virginia points, they're finding other ways to score to make up for that lack of three-point shooting ability.
I thought what they did so well last night, they got the Boston College bigs in foul trouble in the first half. Quentin Post, yeah, who's their sixth man, but is scores 9 points a game for Boston College. He got 3 fouls in the first half. TJ Bickerstaff, who also scores right around 9 points a game, had 2 fouls in the first half. And they got those guys in foul trouble and then just kept pounding it inside. Caden Shedrick ends up with 13 points. A box score showed that points in the paint was 24-24, but when you look at it, Jaden Gardner and Caden Shedrick and Francisco Cafaro combined to hit 14 free throws. Boston College's bigs only had 2 combined free throws. So really, Virginia won the points in the paint battle 38-26. And if you can't shoot threes, you don't shoot threes. That's the frustrating thing about early this season. You would see games, the JMU game, more than half the field goal attempts from Virginia were from 3-point range for a team that shoots at about 31-32%. This team has learned to get into the lane, attack, even the guards attacking so well. Beekman with his 7 assists last night. He gets in the lane, he kicks it out, he's finding guys. They're doing a great job there. And the defense last night, the defense this season has been, it's either been great or it's been horrible. It's not been anything in between. The last 2 home wins, the win over Louisville and then last night, held Louisville to 52, a Louisville team that had in the 80s last night in a loss to UNC at the Yum Center, and then holding BC to 55. That this team is proving it can play and play defense. It's just got to do it consistently, and that's going to be the key there. Consistently being patient enough and disciplined enough to get the ball inside, whether it be to your bigs or with your guards, and then every possession playing like it's the last possession, like other Virginia teams have defensively. If they can play like they did last night, they can win some more games.
Yeah, and, you know, Tony's message to them for the last several games is play to your max, particularly on defense. He told them last night that this was going to have to be a strong defensive effort, that a lukewarm defensive effort was not going to get the job done. And in a very physical game last night, they did. They played really good defense. And another thing I've been impressed with is the fact that if Cafaro or Shedrick or even Gardner, if they can't get their hands on a rebound, they've been intelligent and savvy enough to slap the ball back outside to the guards and keep the possession alive. And that's helped them numerous times in the past couple of weeks.
Jack Salt was always so good at that. And yes. seeing these guys, I mean, we know Mamadou Diakite, the famous play at the end of the Purdue game, but Jack Salt made a living doing that for 4 years in Charlottesville. And, you know, it doesn't count as a rebound for you, and you'll often see Virginia's guards with more rebounds. At least sometimes you'll see Virginia's guards with more rebounds than the bigs. But those bigs, Jack Salt, again, he only averaged less than 4 rebounds a game for his career. He was so good at boxing out, and he was so good at those slapbacks that, that's really important. Important in general for this Virginia team. When I broke down the defensive deficiencies, and we'll talk about, you know, how Miami plays into one of them, the next opponent Saturday in JPJ, the three-point shooting part of it. But defensive rebounding had been an issue for this Virginia team. You know, last year's Virginia team had it at right around 10% higher average rebounding rate defensively than this year's Virginia team. And when you play Tony Bennett-style defense, you're forcing shots. You're supposed to, you know, force bad shots. You're really not oriented towards forcing a lot of turnovers. Virginia did last night with Reese Beekman leading the ACC in steals. They are forcing more turnovers than usual, but really the pack line is built to just force tough shots and then rebound the ball. And if the defense is designed to do that, and then you don't rebound the ball, that, for example, Carolina controlled that game on the boards. Armando Bacot had 21 rebounds in that game. If they're not going to rebound, they're not going to win. They did last night. They did. What was it? I guess even the Notre Dame game, Virginia controlled the boards in that one. They just didn't get the win. So, what we've been seeing lately on that has been really key for this Virginia team, I think.
And and to your point of some of the guards getting rebounds, the second leading rebounder for Virginia last night was Kihei Clark.
Little man getting the boards.
More than a foot shorter than Caden Shedrick, who had 8.
So talking about that next opponent, Miami, they are a perimeter shooting team in ACC games, shooting over 41% from 3. Tony talked about that last night. I think some of the players did too. What were Tony's thoughts about Miami coming up on Saturday?
He just talked about how they have a smaller lineup with a lot of guards. They can all shoot the 3, and they like to spread you out. And that's how teams have beaten Virginia for the most part this season, is spreading them out, kicking the ball out to an open 3-point shooter, and those guys can light you up if you don't get out on them, and or at least try to take them off the line, force them back inside the arc, or if you just don't arrive in time and you give them an open jump shot from out there. I think that's his concern, and I'm sure that's going to be the point of emphasis in practice this week, is trying to put some pressure on those 3-point shooters. And it's going to be interesting. I'm actually happy that Jim Larrañaga is having a good year. I got to know him, obviously, when I got here, and he was on Terry Holland's staff, and always had a lot of respect for that guy, and have followed him throughout his career. Such a good guy. And I know some people at Miami, maybe in their fan base or somebody, they were trying to put a little heat on him after last season. But they probably had more injuries the last 2 or 3 years, Chris, than any team in the conference. And I felt so bad for Jim, because his teams played so hard, he coached so hard, and wanted to win so badly. Now they're starting to Did I hear right when Tony said they have five or six sixth-year players on that roster?
That is correct. Yeah, because of those injuries. I mean, he got the extra COVID year and then the injuries. I mean, he hasn't been to a tournament, NCAA tournament, since 2018 because of all his guys who just every season they start with promise and then guys get hurt they've been healthy this year. And they're 8-2 in the ACC. Now, they do have a game tonight. So, Virginia has a one-game head start advantage, a one-day head start advantage. They play Notre Dame tonight. Now, at least for Miami, it's in Miami. It's in Coral Gables. Virginia has the extra day to prepare. I'll tell you what, one thing that is tough about this matchup, I mean, the three-point shooting in general, but it's that their best three-point shooter is Sam Wardenburg. They're 5. He's a 6'10 center. And kind of reminds you of Nate Leshewski last week for Notre Dame. That's tough for anybody, but it was tough last week for Virginia to keep up. Tony tried Gardner on Leshewski some, and then that didn't work out because they would take him in the post, and then Shedrick and Cafaro having to chase him around on those pick and pops and stick with him on the pick and rolls proved tough. He got some open looks. Leshewski had two good games against Virginia last year as well. So Wardenburg could be a challenge for this team because of the way they run their offense. They run it so well.
Yeah, that's a very tough matchup for just about any team to have somebody who can match those skills of being effective inside and out on the three-point line. It's kind of like Jay Huff was for Virginia last year, where a lot of people had to chase him out to the three-point line and weren't very comfortable doing it, and he made people pay. But it sounds like this guy might be a little bit more of a force inside than perhaps Huff was. But unless you are talking about the Kihei's alley-oop passes to Huff, which seem to define gravity sometimes with Huff catching him way above the rim and slamming him home. But yeah, that's going to be that's going to add to the equation on Saturday with all those little guards out there jacking threes and then having a guy of his size and ability to go out and do it too. It's going to be interesting to see what Tony and his guys come up with in terms of a defensive philosophy to combat that.
Yeah, their offense is built perfectly to go against the pack line defense. And we've seen Miami teams, even the last few years, the ones that have struggled, have given Virginia fits. So it should be an interesting matchup in JPJ on Saturday. I guess it's Saturday night, even though it's 5 o'clock. Sure. Five o'clock, but the sun's already gone down by that point. And it's certainly going to be cold. So it'll be nighttime by the time we're out of there anyway. So that might wrap us up, Jerry. Anything else to throw in as we get ready to wind down on this podcast?
I don't think so. I did go over to Baseball Media Day yesterday, and we can get into that further down the road because they don't play for a while. But Brian O'Connor seemed very excited. They had a scrimmage yesterday at Disharoon Park, and it was interesting because when I walked into the stadium, the interviews were outside, and some of the grounds crew was still trying to get ice and snow off the field. So hopefully nobody got hurt during that inter-squad scrimmage yesterday. But he was excited about the potential of this year's team, and they had just gotten through a ceremony a few days before of handing out the College World Series rings to last year's team. So he's jacked up and ready to go. We'll try to get him on a podcast before they take the field for real.
Yeah, number 5 preseason in Baseball America's national poll. So a lot of promise for this year's Virginia baseball team. We've seen the schedule. There's some good ACC matchups coming up in the spring when the weather gets warmer and the rest of us don't have snow. See, the rest of us don't have grounds crews to clear our snow. So no, we're all waiting for Mother Nature, and Mother Nature hasn't been cooperating as far as that goes, but looking forward to that as far as that goes. It's only a couple weeks away from the opening weekend for Virginia. They'll be down in North Carolina playing some games. They'll be back up. I think it's February 22nd. They open that home with VMI.
Highest listened to podcast was a baseball one last year when we were already in the College World Series and we had Paul Maneri on, the now retired LSU coach, a longtime best friends with Brian O'Connor, and we were getting him to talk about Virginia's and Tennessee's matchup. And lo and behold, we were unaware of this, Palmieri gave us breaking news that he had tried to convince LSU to hire Brian O'Connor as the next head coach at LSU, which is maybe the best, if not one of the best, baseball jobs in America.
I think that's the best baseball job. Yeah, because of the fan base and the rabid support they get there. Here's how unaware of that news we were.
And O'Connor had turned him down, and we broke the news. We had like maybe it was 100,000 Cajuns out there that was listening, but it blew up our podcast numbers.
How unaware we were. I know, Jerry, when we were recording that podcast, I heard him say that, and it was in response to a question about not that. He just brought that up on his own. And so, of course, it was like a 45 or 50-minute podcast, and he's talking about Tennessee. And so I transcribed the notes and wrote about previewing the Tennessee game with Virginia. And then I think you either emailed me or texted me the next day to say that the hometown paper there in Baton Rouge had this news about how LSU had apparently been going after Brian O'Connor, and it was on our podcast. And we're like, oh, my God, I can't believe we missed that. Because we're so focused on the UVA part of the story, the College World Series part, that the LSU folks heard our podcast and they had to listen deep because, again, we didn't headline that. We didn't like podcast where Maneri says that LSU tries to hire O'Connor. So somebody at LSU had to like listen to that whole podcast. It was almost at the end of the podcast. So then the rest of LSU Nation did too, apparently.
Absolutely. And Virginia did the right thing once they learned that LSU had been after the coach, and they gave O'Connor a contract extension and I believe a raise. So Palmieri did Brian O'Connor a big favor there.
Well, and I guess by extension we did too. So maybe that's why Brian was seeking you out yesterday when you were there at Disharoon. He owes us a little bit. Maybe he should take us out for dinner or something like that. I don't know.
There you go. A couple of beers or something.
A couple of beers or something. Yeah, yeah. We'll work on getting Brian on. We'll see if we can get Tony Elliott on because 25 minutes with about 12 reporters wanting to ask questions is just not enough time. We're only two guys. We'll do him some good there. We'll see if we can.
Jim Daves, the SID or media relations director, would have extended that, I'm sure, but Tony was set to get on an ACC football call of some kind, I guess with other coaches or something, and I only had 25 minutes to visit, but it'd be nice to have him to ourselves for however much time he can give to us.
Whatever he gives us, we'll be happy with, right? So we'll work.
Absolutely.
Well, Jerry, thanks for your time. Thanks to our listeners out there. We'll see if we can get together later this week and maybe do some more talking baseball, talking basketball, getting ready for the UVA Miami game. See if we can get ourselves back together. But in the meantime, I want to thank everybody for listening, and everyone have a great day.